Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 795.
I got a real good one. It's a very nerdist thing. It's called the Harry Potter Alliance.
You did it.
Son of a bitch.
Sorry.
God damn it. I spent so much time figuring out what they do.
Oh. That's the book thing, right?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Show 'em Comedy Festival it is. All right. You want to tee me off again?
No, it's okay.
I kind of loved all of you guys. Son of a bitch.
All right. I got the Show'em Comedy Festival, which is both a comedy festival and a cool charity thing where they're taking all of the, or a fair amount of the proceeds, and they're going towards different good quality things that show that laughter can do more than just be dark people talking on stage.
That's fantastic. It was also fun watching the high wire act of that sentence.
Me
being
trying
formed.
To. Sometimes
these
when you're
are
trying
words
to.
We don't know where
when
they're
I'm
ending.
Trying to
soon.
Promote things, sometimes I forget that you have to say all nice things and not dive into darkness, which is my default.
Yeah.
But go to showemcomedyfestival.com and check out what they do because they're doing really cool stuff.
Katie.
Newlyweds Moshe Kasher and Natasha Leggero are doing a honeymoon tour.
Aww.
Yeah, it's really exciting. They're such a great couple.
They're amazing.
And it starts in Hawaii on May 22nd, and then they're going to Washington, Oregon, all throughout California. You can find info and tickets at moshekasher.com.
I think it's Hawaii. I think it's Oregon. I think it's Washington.
Why did you throw a hand shaka out for every single one of those states?
You did it
for Hawaii, but then also Oregon.
Well, I don't know. I just...
a cool Hawaiian guy in every state.
Yeah. Look at this, Howley. Actually, I sounded more. I'm not sure that was the right.
I love that character. Oh, look at this Howley over here.
Oh, yeah. That's the 1920s.
Audrey Hepburn in Hawaii.
Yes, you know I love when the Howleys come in.
I was hanging out with Jonah Ray. He's my knight
him.
In shining armor.
He certainly is my Portuguese sausage. this was really fun. I went up and did a Periscope, like an hour-long Periscope with the founders of Twitter because Monday was the 10th anniversary of Twitter. And so they said, do you want to moderate this? And I said, well... I know I have to do Talking Dead Sunday night. I have to be at midnight on Monday. And they said, well, it's Monday morning at 8 a.m. in San Francisco. And I said, you know what? I'm going to do it because I've always wanted to meet these guys. And I feel like...
Did you fly out after Talking Dead on Sunday?
Yeah. And then
you're an insane person.
And then
person.
I flew back in time for the morning meeting at midnight.
Jesus Christ.
So, but I felt like it was very important for me to do it. I wanted to thank these guys in person because so much of what I do... It would not have existed without Twitter.
The at sign.
Without the ad symbol. At midnight, for example. But even just the communities of, you know, people that for Talking Dead and for Nerdist and the podcast and for everything. And so I wanted to meet him and I wanted to thank them. And so I went up and did this. And it was a really great chat. It's very Twitter centric.
Nice.
So I'm just telling people if you're like, oh, you're going to talk about his Twitter. Well, yeah, we're going to talk about his Twitter. We were there for the 10th anniversary, but I thought it was such a fun chat that I said, can I put this up as a podcast? And they go, sure. So they just gave me the audio. So this is me talking on the 10th anniversary of Twitter at Twitter HQ in San Francisco with Ev Williams, Jack Dorsey, and Biz Stone. And it was great and very enlightening, and they were very nice.
God, it's so weird to think there was a time before Twitter. It's just everywhere now.
Yeah, I know.
Like, there's at handles and Twitter handles just everywhere you look.
It's hard to imagine a time before.
That's so weird.
Yeah, I know. But here we are. And thank you very much, Twitter. I'm going to say thank you.
Yeah.
Here's Nerds Podcast number 795, bonus episode this week with Ev Williams, Jack Dorsey, Biz Stone, creators and founders of Twitter, right here in the Nerds Podcast. Katie, tweet the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
I'm Chris Hardwick. I'm here at the Twitter headquarters with a fabulous view of the Golden Gate Bridge, which looks much more two-dimensional from this far away. I'm here with the founders of Twitter, Ev and Biz and Jack, whom I've never met any of you before, and it is a tremendous honor to meet you. There were very few things that I would leave Talking Dead last night, get on a plane, come up here, and then immediately have to go back to work back when I get back home, but pretty much everything that I've been able to do has centered around Twitter in some way, and it has been such a significant thing for everything I do. It was very important for me.
Us too.
That's so crazy. So it's the 10th. It's your 10th anniversary. Did you have any inkling 10 years ago that this is where everything
it flew would, by like 10 minutes underwater?
What are some of the highlights? So right now, Twitter has 320 million active users. 1 billion unique visits a month.
That's all me.
That's just you. 80% active users on mobile. You have 3,900 employees around the world. So just kind of love to get some beats about where it started. He's wearing his Twitter shirt. You're wearing your Twitter
shirt. I designed that shirt, and I don't have one anymore.
Why aren't you? Why are you not wearing it?
It
should be matching.
I forgot.
Did you say you were going to wear it, and then you were the one?
No, I didn't. I couldn't find it because I regularly purge my closet, and I accidentally purged my most treasured T-shirt.
So where did Twitter come from? What was the idea behind it, and how did you guys think it would be something that people would be interested in?
Do you want me to tell my version of the story?
Yeah, why don't you tell your version of the story, and then they can
we'll
edit you.
Yeah. I'll tell my version, and then Jack will tell me I'm wrong. But my version is that Ev said, look, things aren't going well at our other company that we were doing, and why don't you guys all just
podcasting? That obviously wasn't going to go.
We were doing.
Yeah. It ended up working out.
It wasn't podcasting, but it was podcasting so long ago that it was too early.
You were like maybe 4 years ahead of your time with podcasting.
Maybe even further. Anyway, back. Anyway, so Ev said, look, things aren't going good. Why don't you guys all just pair up? And I think there was like 12 of us or something. 10 of us, 12 of us. Why don't you guys all just pair up? Just work on something crazy, except for a couple guys still have to work on OU. And I think he picked the anarchists to keep working on OU. Anyway,
they didn't listen.
Yeah, they didn't do it. So as I recall, Jack and I had always been finding ways to work together at ODL, like doing little projects. Like, wouldn't it be funny if when the system crashes, it says the system's crashed, okay, and I put a little checkbox that says, but I'm not happy about it. And he was like, that's right, let's do it. So we would just do weird things like that. And so for me, it was kind of like when you're asked to find a partner in gym class, and you're like, don't worry about it. You know what I mean? It was like an understanding. And so we got together, and I was like, I just want to do something simple.
It's going to take a while, by the way.
Something that I can just totally understand. And I was like, how about picture blogging? Just you take a picture, and that's it. That's all you do. It's one picture, one blog. And Jack had obviously been thinking about this for a while, and he said, I have a different idea. That's a great idea. But he pointed to his AOL Instant Messenger, and he pointed to the statuses of each person, and he said, do you notice how they're meant for online, offline, but he said, do you see how some of my friends are like saying actually what they're doing, that they're having a bad day, da, da, da. And he asked me, do you think we could make a whole thing just out of knowing what your contacts are doing without even asking them? And I was like, that's genius, let's do it. That's how I remember like the very first idea, and then we like built it up. But Jack had already put some thought into it.
We were also doing a ton with phones and SMS in the company.
Yeah,
and we were super excited. We were playing with SMS groups, and we were rethinking ODO to be more group based, and it was this one push button way to broadcast yourself. Using your voice, but we're exploring ways of doing it with a group, and actually have more group broadcasts as well. And SMS was just getting big in the United States at that time, and we were all pretty enamored with it, fascinated by it, and using it nonstop, learning it very quickly and making a lot of mistakes along the way.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a, we realized the problem with podcasts at the time was they're interesting when you're away from your computer, not when you're at your computer, but getting them, so you wanted them on the phone, but it was like a year before the iPhone, right?
Yeah.
And so actually putting something on the phone was a pain in the butt. So SMS was this intriguing way to get things to people's phones. And we entered it through, well, how do we get the audio to people's phones? And then it turns out other things make sense on the phones as well.
Not just audio.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Jack actually, I remember him thinking, like, we could also add audio. And I was like, oh, God, no.
So it was basically like just kind of Unix philosophy of, like, we just want something that just does one thing and it does it very well. And you didn't want to crowd it with a bunch of other stuff right off the bat.
And also in the Unix philosophy, very hacky to start. We hooked all these systems up in place together. We learned everything about SMS. We had our SMS stack running on a little old Windows laptop that crashed.
I remember, no, on Windows laptop. I unplugged it. Remember when we got the bill for $250,000 and I just unplugged it?
Like, did that make it go away? Did the bill go away?
the laptop at one point was paying for everyone outside of North America. We were paying for all their SMS bills. And the UPS guy was bringing us. They were bringing us boxes of, back then they would bring you your bill with your texts in it.
Oh no.
So the guy with the bills was like dumping off bottom, and I was like, with the texts. So I just unplugged the
You did unplug the service for everyone.
I thought I was just doing it for Europe, but
and so at that
no offense to Europeans.
What was the first tweet that went out?
They were all the same.
Well, so when we first created the system, the way we did it is when you created an account for yourself, it would actually tweet for you. And it would say, just setting up my Twitter, TWTTR.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it was TWTTR is because we wanted to be very focused on SMS, and we were trying to get an SMS shortcode.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to get TWTTR as our shortcode, but we learned that it was owned by
teen people.
And they weren't willing to give it up, so it was text TP. Instead of TWTTR.
We also couldn't, we didn't want to buy Twitter.com because it was a bird enthusiast owned it.
Mm-hmm.
Later we bought it.
Completely against bird enthusiasts.
No, my wife is.
Well, you took him down.
My wife is actually a huge bird enthusiast. But we eventually bought it. We were able to make the joke that we bought the vowels.
Yeah, that was the idea of sending out what was, I guess, philosophically like just texts via internet. How long before? When did you start kind of? What did you initially think it was going to be used for? And when did you start seeing it evolved? Because I think one of the best things about Twitter is that so much of the utility of Twitter has kind of been dictated by your audience. You guys have listened to a lot of that. And I'm sure people always complain when they know who you are, like, will you add this? Can you add an edit button? Can you do this? But you really, it seems like you've listened as much as you can and turn it over. And the audience kind of dictated how it's used. So how did you initially see it being used? And what are you surprised about now?
I think we saw it as something that was fun.
It was a joy to use. Yeah, Jack was just like, wouldn't it be fun if you could just know what everyone was feeling and up to and sort of get the heartbeat of all the people you care about without even bothering them, you know? And it was like, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
We kept riffing on it as well. So when you created an account, it said, just setting up my Twitter, I'm going to teach you how to tweet a bit. And then the next thing was inviting coworkers, and that's when we sent the invites to everyone else at Odeo, and you see this string of chain reactions where just setting up my Twitter, and then people got onto it. And that day, we all went home, and we were still using it, and we were talking about what was happening at home when we weren't physically together.
Yeah.
And that started to feel like magic, because like it did bring us closer even though we weren't physically next to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we kept seeing that feeling and that experience again and again and again. And Biz has a great story around
the very first time I felt like we were onto something was when I was my wife and I had this little tiny 400 square foot house in Berkeley, and it was a heat wave, and I'd watched enough Bob Vila as a kid to know that when you rip up the carpeting, you reveal the beautiful hardwood floors underneath.
Right.
So I decided to start in the middle with a big utility knife, and I just cut the carpet, ripped it like this, and there was no hardwood floor whatsoever.
So you just destroyed your carpet.
Destroyed my carpet, but then I had to keep ripping, so I was ripping and ripping and ripping, and I was sweating, and I was like, God, I made this huge mistake, and I was angry, and I was upset, and then I felt my phone buzz in my pocket, and it was Ev, and his tweet was, sipping Pinot Noir after a massage in Napa Valley. And and my wife already thought I was crazy because I was cursing and everything, and then I was laughing out loud, and she was like, oh my God, he's totally lost it. But because I was laughing out loud, I sort of had this out-of-body experience where I was like, am I laughing out loud from a product we made? That we must be on the right track. Because if you're using it and laughing, then like something's going right, you know?
What did you learn from your audio experience that you were able to use when you started Twitter?
For me, it was don't try to do it all. Because we had, in audio, we had the studio where you recorded, the directory where you tried to find podcasts you like, and like a lot of other stuff. We were just podcasting.
It was complicated.
It was just everything. And it was way better to just, why would you record in your browser when you could just record on GarageBand and not crash, you know?
But going back to the how did it evolve, I think that these early stories were profound in that we felt it was a personal connection between people in real time. That sounds completely mundane today, and it was profound at the time. And so we were very focused on that, though, the first couple of years. If you look at the homepage, was a way to tell it, friends, family, and coworkers what you're up to in real time or something like that.
Yeah.
Right? And so, which is, we realized later was cool and a subset of what this real-time information network could be. And that's the thing we started discovering as it went out into the world in those early days was like, there's wildfires in Southern California and the fire department is tweeting about where they're at, mm-hmm. which has nothing to do with telling your friends and family, but it's actually critical information that we are providing a new way to get out.
Or there was an earthquake. For me, there was an earth. I was in the BART underground, and I was about to get on the train, and I heard people mumbling about an earthquake, and I was like, "Whoa, I'm not getting on this train." And then, or I was already on the train. I was like, I'm going to run off this train. And then my phone was like, dzz, 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 and it was all these tweets about, it's no big deal, earthquake, Hayward Fault, like it was at 1.2 or whatever. And I was like, oh, I'll just stay on the train. And so it saved me from being like home late for dinner and stuff. And I was like, that was pretty useful.
Well, because when Twitter first started, I think maybe you guys had some sort of an integration. I think my friends who were in this thing called Human Giant were doing like the MTV Movie Awards or something, and they had all gotten Twitter accounts early on.
That was their first like sort of commercial thing.
Yeah, and I think Aziz was tweeting backstage, and I was reading like, oh, there's status updates, you know. But my first thought was like, well, that'll get old fast. Like, what do you think? What could you possibly say to someone that you need to say all the time? Mm-hmm. But then I kept reading and I kept reading and I kept reading, and then. And I think in the beginning, it was kind of fun, and I think people were like, oh, it's a silly thing. People were just telling you what they had for breakfast.
Right.
Then there was an earthquake.
That lasted like 3-4 years, by the way.
But I think it went up until, I'm pretty sure, I don't know if it was 08 or 09, there was an earthquake in L.A., and of course, all the cell towers jammed, and everyone got all of their news on Twitter. And it was the first time that I really felt the sense of, oh, wait, this is actually... This isn't just a narcissism tool. This is a real way to get information and find out what people are talking about in real time and get information out as quickly as possible. Did it ever occur to you that the platform would have such weight to it at any point? Or it really just was like, oh, it'll just be silly and fun?
Well,
it occurred to me at a certain point, but you started talking.
No, but it evolves. I mean, as you... The other thing that I learned from audio is like, you have to be passionate about what you're building. And... We loved audio, but we weren't broadcasters. We weren't podcasters. We loved listening to them. And this is something that we just... Twitter was something that we wanted to use every minute of every day and just naturally wanted to make better and better and better. And we saw as people got on it, they would use it in all these interesting ways that we weren't predicting. And that newsworthiness, the citizen journalists, being in the right moment, being at the right place at the right time, and being able to share what's happening on the ground was phenomenal. And,
or in space.
Or in space. And or off this planet.
Yeah.
But just being, you know, that public, by default nature of the service allowed you to really see what the world was saying at any point. And we saw these interesting behaviors that we made easier and easier and easier as the service grew.
The other thing I was going to say was that the first point where I felt like we truly invented something, some new form of human communication, was when I heard the story of a guy who was at a tech conference at a lab pub, and he just wanted to talk to his other tech friends about stuff. And so he sent out a tweet that says, "How about we go to this other pub down the street?" And in the 8 minutes it took him to walk to that pub, it had become full to capacity with a line around the block. And it was because his followers retweeted, like they retweeted the same thing, and then those followers retweeted, and so on. And so many individuals suddenly acted as one, like a, you know, flock of birds going around a tree. It looks so choreographed, so beautiful, but the mechanics of flocking are actually very simple. And I was like, when I heard that story, I thought to myself, this was just a party scenario, but what if it had been a disaster or something? Many all of a sudden becoming one and then becoming individuals again. I was like, whoa, there's no other way to do that.
When you started to sense that, when you started to sense that there was real social importance behind it, did that change the way you approached your work at that point? Oh, well, we kind of need to really think about this in a grander scale than we had before. And it's not just a frivolous tool.
Well, yeah, anymore. Actually, after that is when we formed Twitter Inc. formally, like when we got back. We also won an award at that tech conference.
And it was South by Southwest. So
right. Yeah, which just happened.
So basically, what happened was we were going into the awards, and just because everybody did, and then I said to Evan Jack, I was like, "What if we win an award?" And they were like, "What do you mean?" And I was like, "We could win. We might win. We're not prepared to win.
I think we're up for best blog."
Mm-hmm. And I was like, "What if we win?" Which made no sense, but. Unless we're talking about my blog posts.
Was that what it was?
No.
Because I really think it might be more than sipping the Pinot rather than your
coffee
cutting.
But anyways, I said, "What if we win?" And I suddenly got this weird feeling like, oh, shoot, we could win. And I was like, good point. Jack will speak. You'll write the speech. Okay. And so I was like, how can I write a speech in like 5 minutes? And so I decided to play off the 140 character limit. And I said, I think the speech was... for Jack was, "I'd like to thank you in 140 characters or less," and I just did. And we just walked off.
That was it.
Yeah.
And you, obviously, over the years, and certainly in the newsletter, people were like, more than 140 characters, more than 140 characters. But I love the economy of 140 characters, because I think it has forced me to not waste words. It's forced me to economize, and I think it's forced most people to not go off in four paragraphs what they could get across in one simple idea.
There's a poetry to it, but there's a really practical reason as well, which is we had to fit under this 160 character boundary for SMS, and if we could do that, then one tweet would not be broken across multiple text messages, which means that when you tweet, you only get one. And we took 20 characters for the at name, and then we arrived at 140. But it was this, you know, beautiful.
Didn't we take 15 for the name, and there was like 5 wasted?
Yeah.
I once proposed 5 character ads.
And it didn't
be really tricky.
But it didn't work.
We didn't try.
We had tips at one point if there were room.
Yeah.
But the very early version, we didn't cut it off. If you entered the tweet on the web, we'd send multiple texts, mm-hmm. and then you would get the second one, and you'd assume it was. But if there's a delay, you didn't know who that was from.
Yeah,
and then we made it so it had to be limited one, but it depended on how long your username was.
Yeah.
So if you had a shorter username, you could actually have
like,
longer.
I had one more character than Jack did because I was Biz, and he had one more character than me because he was Ed.
Yeah. So it was your username plus the colon plus the space. And then I remember one day Jack just said, 140.
That's it, 140, and that's all it is.
Like, well, that seems wasteful that you could get a few things in there. We talked about ads or tips, right. Which we actually did tips at one point, for which were as helpful but via SMS because you didn't necessarily know how to do it.
Yeah.
Well, how do you use Twitter? Like, when you first started using it, how were you using it? And then what does it mean to you now?
it's definitely evolved from this very personal, here's what I'm doing. I think the Very Old Tweets account is regularly embarrassing because it will retweet very old tweets. Mm-hmm. And but it was fun. I mean, is when you are just talking to your friends, or your perception is you're just talking to your friends, you talk differently and you're much more casual than if there's a huge audience listening to you. So it's gotten, I think, more formal for me. It's obviously gotten more powerful. I'm a sporadic tweeter, but a very habitual tweet, you know, reader and mm-hmm. checker, and its main source of news. That is the only consistent source of news I check. Yeah. So it's a lot of things to me. It's a utility. It's a broadcast platform. It's still a way that I private message with most of the people I know. It's the default connection that I use.
Yeah. DMs. Yeah.
What about you, Jack?
It is the fastest way that I can learn about what's happening in the world. I mean, it's the first thing I check when I wake up, and I go straight to the search tab and I see the trends, and it's amazing because you get to see like what everyone's talking about in an instant.
When did you figure that out? Because around the time of the earthquake, people were talking about Twitter's real power being finding out what large people are talking about in real time, exactly like what you're saying. But obviously, that you couldn't have foreseen that right away, right? Or did you see that right away?
No, I mean we saw this global conversation because when we first started on the web, we had this everyone page, mm-hmm. and you could actually see every tweet from every single person that was using the service, and it was updated live, and it was just the most electrifying thing because you could actually see all these things in real time, but you wouldn't know what was truly happening unless you spent some time really going into each one of those and pausing it a bit. And it wasn't until we acquired some eyes in search, they had this interesting trending algorithm. So before, you had to follow people and you would hope that they would be reporting or tweeting about what you cared about and what was interesting, what was happening in the world. Trends enabled you to bubble up what people were talking about. And so if they were talking about one particular topic or one particular hashtag, you would see it instantly, even though you don't follow those people.
Right.
And that decision to build in search or bring in search via SMIs and trends was based on this observation that Twitter could be beyond the personal and beyond the social. And so it was this learning process of seeing what people are doing with it, but also saying, well, what's the most important thing we could create? And because if it was purely a social network, which, you know, it was basically classified on as early on, and it is one, then you wouldn't necessarily build search or build trends or build the ability to see what the world is talking about. But that's the direction that we chose to go with those, and then retweets and other things. So information could spread throughout the system across the boundaries of your social connections.
It is interesting to see how many things evolved out of Twitter and Twitter's usage that you see on almost all the social networks now. Everyone uses trending. Everyone uses hashtags. Where did
even follow was not
even follow?
Yeah. I remember these guys suggested the term follow, and we debated
whether it should be listen or follow
or subscribe.
And so or subscribe. But since I was designing the website, I just made it say follow.
I don't think it was that controversial, but we did
lock
talk about
whether
or not it was creepy. I was like, is it creepy to follow someone?
I didn't think it was creepy because I was thinking of it like news. Like, are you following this story in
right.
the news about this? Or like, you know, or when you're talking, which I talk a lot, are you following me? Do you follow me here?
But it's
not a bit like that.
But it's but there's also a layer of separate. There is a layer of protection where it doesn't feel like someone's right on top of it.
I had an idea for a T-shirt at one point. Instead of the, I made multiple T-shirts, but one T-shirt idea was on the back. It would just say, "Are you following me?" and people would just be like, "What does that mean?" Anyway,
now they know.
But the we designed briefly a feature. Remember this? We had following, and then. We had a sun and a moon, and you could, the moon meant like, don't disturb me with tweets right now, unless, and we had this feature called worship. And that was like, don't disturb me unless the one of these three people tweets. Then I definitely want to know.
Then you want to know.
Those are the people I worship.
You could follow someone or you could worship someone. Yeah, and you would always get the tweets to your phone.
No matter what.
No matter what, if you worship
them. That was weird. That was cultish. So we dropped all that stuff.
I think now you can get away with it because people know what the platform is. And I don't think anyone would be like, that's so weird. I mean, I think that's pretty, like a turbo follow.
Also, the like,
that's a better name than worship.
Yeah. Turbo follow. Now, like, the phones do it. They have, like, a little moon, like, nighttime.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't bother me.
We built that in. And we,
it was like, it's like time to go to bed. Like, I'll wait for the tweets tomorrow. Yeah.
How did someone take an Octothorpe and basically create the hashtag revolution?
Octothorpe? Is that the real word?
I think that's what that thing, I think it's called Octothorpe.
Wow. Holy moly, I didn't even know it. I thought it was called
the pounds. Shut it down.
Octothorpe.
I'm pretty sure it's an Octothorpe. I'm sure someone on the internet will correct me.
Octothorpe is some kind of sea creature that is bioluminescent.
It was able to tag other sea creatures.
Oh my god, that's crazy. Octothorpe.
Any sea creature that it's near, it's just easier to catalog it.
You learn something new every day.
We grew up in the time of Flickr, and we were inspired a lot by Flickr. And there were a lot of tag
uses. Grew up in the time of Flickr.
Grew up in the time of
Flickr. Flickr was very influential.
Flickr was.
We didn't grow up in the time of Flickr.
Yeah, we did. We did.
You did, man.
Well, I don't know. I'm 25. Oh, 25. You must be 26.
Of course. I'm just referring to our 10-year-old.
referring to Twitter at being 10. You're right.
Twitter's a kid. Twitter's a 10-year-old now. Yeah, Twitter's running around trying to figure out.
10-year-old. We got the favorite from Flickr. We got the removal of the original vowels.
That's true. We actually got the terms of service from our lawyers, and all they did was copy Flickr and put it in. And we were like, okay, here's $900. Wait, it says Flickr. You couldn't even do a find and replace?
That's an extra $100. For $1,000, they would have done a find and replace. Yeah, Flickr was, I remember that when I first started getting on Flickr, we're like, wow, this is really, I could see all these other people.
People were tagging your photos, and you're like, this is great, I don't have to do any work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Chris Messina brought it over to Twitter and started using it.
The Octothorpe.
The Octothorpe and it worked.
he actually came into our office and he's like, I have a good idea. We should put a hashtag in front of a word, and that should mean you're tagging your tweet so that you don't have to constantly say, in reference to this, like, if you're at South by Southwest, you can say the tacos are great. I'm at South by Southwest every time. And you can just be like, hashtag South by Southwest.
It's just like a contextual reference point, which it's just a nice, it's been a nice anchor, but what I'm sure you, because you're obviously like a comedy guy, you are. The comedy guy, I mean that in the best possible way, but comedy,
because comedy guys are hardworking guys.
Comedy guys are hardworking guys, but all of my friends who were when the stand-ups start, when we all got on Twitter, that using the hashtag became a way to basically like a parenthetical for a joke or a way to contextualize a joke.
Well, so it's also ironic.
Great comedy tool.
People are using their text messages now just for like irony.
Yeah,
like hashtag I'm stupid and whatever after you say something.
When I first started using the hashtag outside Twitter. Just to be snarky, I would hashtag something, and the second hashtag would be like hashtagging outside of Twitter, just a hashtag and then the word hashtag.
I kind
of
wish every hashtag everywhere just worked, just actually did link
back to Twitter,
like in email, in text, in everything. I wish they really did work.
I guess you can't copyright that when that happened. I mean, that is an interesting question.
It would just be cool if they all worked across platforms, because then you'd really get some cool.
Does that bother you? Do you ever feel like, ugh, when you see features that you got, that are you just happy that it's out in
the
world?
It's great, yeah. It's awesome. Like, follow, hashtag.
Twitter's a true original. Like, everything. No, it has. Like, we created so much, and the people using our platform created so much, and it's gone beyond Twitter into culture. It's inspiring. It's huge.
I'm sure you guys must get asked all the time, for like people starting up companies, because you've achieved what anyone would want to achieve if they were in Silicon Valley and they wanted to start something. So what is it, what was the most important thing about this experience that you learned that you would pass on to people?
Well, what Jack said before is, if I'm only given a chance to give one piece of advice to somebody who wants to be an entrepreneur, I always say, you have to be emotionally invested in what you're doing, which means like love what you're doing, because we were just told Twitter is terrible, stupid, worst idea ever.
From the internet? No. Yeah. It's usually such a positive support structure.
Somebody even said, at one point somebody said, Twitter is the Seinfeld of the internet. It's a website about nothing. And I put that on the rotating testimonials for the front page. I thought it was a compliment. I was like, Seinfeld, a hit show. And everyone was like, you know that's supposed to be a dig at you. And I was like, what do you mean? Seinfeld's huge. So if you're emotionally invested, those things just wash over you and you keep working on it.
Right.
And if you're not, then you're like, ah, everybody's right. I should just move on.
But the other thing to add to that is be emotionally invested, but just follow your gut in terms of what you're creating. Create the thing that you want to exist in the world and know how to make it better based on your own usage of that. Yeah. Not that, I mean, it's a combination, obviously, of that and listening to users, but when you're, if you do too much just listening to people, if we did mostly listening to people, Twitter wouldn't have been,
it wouldn't have been.
It wouldn't have been. Yeah. It wouldn't have been, because it was clearly a silly idea.
Yeah.
But it's that which you always have 1,000 different options about what to do next. And it's not like Twitter was born and suddenly it was a hit and fully formed. It took months of iteration, actually, before that South by Southwest, before there was really any growth. And then every month and every year since, there's been, okay, what do we do now? Because it always has to change and evolve. How it changed and evolved, you have to, especially very early on, this becomes less as you grow, but very early on, it's what do I want or what do we want as a team? What's working for us is your primary barometer. And then you put it out in the world, and then you see how people are reacting and responding to it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the idea. It's interesting. I'd never thought of it this way before, but if you are innovating, it's very difficult to listen to other people because you're making a thing they've never seen. Yeah. So how could they possibly tell you what to do with it?
Right.
When you first start something, it's obviously very exciting because, you know, there's that...
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying, but there is that kind of like sexy honeymoon period. It's like, oh, we're doing this new thing. Then, when you get past that, how do you maintain, like, how do you keep it like a fun, sexy process when it's not brand new anymore, when you just have to keep it going?
I think the team. I mean, it's just, you want to work with people that you love working with, and Biz was great at this. Whenever we had a stressful moment in the company, he always lighted it up a bit and reminded us of why we're here and what we're doing, and really gave us a whole lot of purpose. And he always said Twitter is a triumph of humanity, and really made the work, even though it started in a very lightweight way, made the work feel tangible and real and important and something that mattered. But at the same time, we should be having fun with it. We should have some joy in the work and make it feel great, because otherwise we're not going to do the right things.
Yeah, we used to have every Friday we would have what we call tea time, because Jack thought we would just sit down and have tea, but there was beer in the fridge, so we actually had beer. We still call it tea time. We still call it tea time, but what we would do at tea time is we would stop working and we would show everybody, look what people are doing. Not like celebrate ourselves, but we would celebrate what people were doing on Twitter. Like, look, they self-organized and gave to this charity. Or look at this woman, like, crashed her bike in the middle of nowhere and she tweeted for help and she got help. And we would celebrate those types of things. And so people would feel like our work is important just by coming into the building. I'm already doing something important, plus the work. And then Jack always kept things fresh by saying, like, you know, we shouldn't be afraid to just tear things down and try new things. Like, nothing should be sacred, you know? So the team was always encouraged to just be like, what if we did this and this and this and this and this? And so you get a lot of cool ideas that way, instead of trying to, like, don't touch anything because it's working.
So don't be afraid to take risks. Don't be afraid to fall down.
You got to change it. Yeah, I always say that you have to be willing to
fall. We did fall
down. So we fell down a lot. And I sort of turned it into, like, a joke. And people, I think it actually worked well for us. Like, it broke so much, and people complained so much that it was broken, that people were like, what's breaking? I want to check out this thing that sucks so much. But
Jeff Bezos says that's why he invested, was because Twitter kept failing, and yet it was growing and popular. And he said, "Well, you must be onto something then."
Yeah,
may I invest?
Well, so is there something that at the time you considered like, "Oh, this is a tremendous fail," but in retrospect was maybe one of the better things that happened?
Well, just it's more like in general. You know, I found a stock photo of a bunch of little birds lifting up a whale, and I put it up for, like, you know, like technical difficulties. I'm like, we're working on it. It's a big job, but we're working together. Later on, Ev pointed out that the birds were all flying in different directions, which is like, I was like, that's actually perfect.
I mean, the fail whale became pretty, like, it was, what I think was so great about it is that you didn't get pissed off when it happened. It was like, oh, this is this adorable whale.
Well, actually, early on, we got this great, things were just magical. Like, whenever a big event was going to come up, we knew we were going to have to, like, stay up late and bolster things, try to figure out what might go wrong. And one time we were all in the office working late before at Macworld, huge nerd fest. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, I went to Muskogee.
And
wasn't just a Macworld. It was when they announced when Steve Jobs announced the iPhone.
Yeah,
2007.
So we knew that was going to be. Well, we didn't know. Do we know about the iPhone? Was it?
I don't know.
The point is, we knew that a lot of people were going to be tweeting, and so we were staying up late. And then a pizza showed up. And then another, and I was like, who's ordering all these pizzas? And it turns out, Twitter, the people who were using Twitter and love Twitter, were having pizzas sent to our office because they knew we were probably up late working.
Oh, that's so nice!
It was so awesome.
That was the coolest thing. Even when we did,
and we did work during that
fail and go down, we just had so much love and so much passion for what we were building, and so much patience as well to make sure
people
that
stuck with us. Clones came up everywhere, and people were like, "Yeah, we like these guys that don't quite know what they're doing."
Well, I think that is more relatable than like a giant mega corporation who's trying to basically like, how do we get this audience? Well, but you guys were building a community from the ground up.
Yes, I actually think there is some value in showing vulnerability. You know, it's like you're human. Okay, we're just a bunch of people trying to work on a free thing for you.
These guys put their cell phone number on the website, the very first version.
Yeah, I had an old guy call me really early on a Saturday morning, like, listen, my church told me to get on this thing. And I did your word puzzle. And I was like, what is he talking about? Because I had had this idea for a game over Twitter that day before, and I was like, did we build that? And then I was like, oh, he means CAPTCHA. He means he solved the CAPTCHA.
That's really funny. And so he proved that he was not a robot.
Yeah. So I had to go through. My wife was like, who are you talking to? And I was like, don't worry about it. And then we eventually took our phone numbers off the website.
That's a good idea. But it's fine. I want to get to some user questions. But it's so funny how I imagine you're in this. Sometimes I'm not sure it must feel like a no-win situation where people expect the platform to evolve, but then when you change things, people get so into their ritual. It's like when you went from stars to hearts, it's like people melted down. It's like, but it's still the same functionality. Like, why?
Yeah, except that there's a huge giant heart in the lobby of Twitter. Did you see it?
Yeah.
And it's constantly pulsating because people are constantly clicking the heart. So people love the heart. Also, Ev said something funny. I was like, that thing's constantly pulsing because somewhere someone's always clicking a heart. And he was like, if that stops beating, we literally
die. So Twitter has become sentient, and once that stops, it's all over. This is from Mike Chaffee. What day-to-day uses for Twitter by folks you may consider less techie amaze you most, aside from breaking news?
Well, the one I always go back to, which is kind of ancient now, it's like my favorite tweet. Ev's wife, Sarah. Well, that was cool, too, but he was kind of a techie. But Ev's wife, Sarah, when they were having their first baby, she wrote a short tweet that said, "Dear Internet, my water just broke." I love that because I knew they were going to have a baby, and it was just like, oh, my, this is so cool. Now I know, like, she's going to have a baby. It was really nice. And she's not a techie. She's an artist.
Do you ever feel like sometimes almost like with because, you know, people get super – their faces are in their phone so much of the time. Do you ever feel like sometimes, like, you have to be like the alcohol industry where it's like, drink responsibly, you know, don't
– Yeah.
Be careful with your social media.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things in Twitter now, like, just – catch up or go to Twitter Moments and just kind of scan it and stuff like that instead of just be on your phone all day long.
Yeah.
There was a great picture that was circulating around the internet for a while, maybe last year, and it was a train stop, and everyone at the train stop was looking at their phone, and then there was one guy who was just walking and not looking at his phone, and the caption was, what the F is this guy looking at? The world?
Boring. This is from Khalil Manns. How do you make communities easier for new users to join?
That's your job.
That's been something that's been pretty phenomenal to watch on Twitter. It's just how communities emerge out of nothing, usually around a hashtag. Like people just by using a hashtag, they're suddenly enter into a conversation around a community.
I bet you there's a hashtag Octothorpe performing right now.
There must be. There must be an Octothorpe hashtag out there. Yeah. Instead of saying hashtag,
that's
just be like,
of the day.
Oh, Octothorpe love Twitter. Let's just try to make it as clunky as possible. A lot of people asking questions about the character limit. Roy Clemenston at Roy VQ, like three or four people were like, what about more? What about 150? And we sort of grazed it earlier, and I know you opened that up for DMs, which is phenomenal, by the way. But why is it important for you to keep it as economical as possible?
I think the brevity is very important, and that poetry, that like natural, like of the moment kind of poetry and feeling is really important. But it also creates this behavior where people are using it to point attention to all these interesting things. And that's been awesome to see over time.
Well, it's daunting to some people. It's comforting knowing that that's all you have to write.
Right.
Also, it's if you could craft the great American novel in Twitter, it would be, some people would, and it'd be amazing. And then everybody else would be like, well, I can't do that.
So it'd be off-putting. I think just keeping it simple is the best way to get.
I do think people sometimes forget that too much choice is too much for the human brain. Like you get stressed by that because it just feels like a mess.
What should I do?
There are some other social networks that you go onto and a bunch of people have written like a dissertation. You're like, I can't deal with that right now.
Yeah, like a long email. You just sort of look at the first thing. You're like, what do I skip to the end? Oh, I want to be verified. Okay.
Oh my God, the war for verification was so crazy. And, you know, for whatever reason, I don't know what it was, but Twitter was very kind to... It's funny, like, a lot of it, because at the time I was writing for Wired and I was doing more tech stuff, and Twitter really adopted a lot of the tech nerds who got huge followings, like Veronica Belmont and Ryan Block and Felicia Day and Will Wheaton and me. And so someone threw us on this suggested user list before it was an algorithm.
Yeah.
That it was just like a curated
list.
It's a
horrible mistake, by the way, but God.
What was that? Oh, yes, of course. I'm your fault.
He means it was a mistake because it's much better for people to naturally be attracted to you, and those are the followers you really want, rather than like, hey, follow this guy, okay, click, okay, whatever you put in front of me, I'll click. I don't know who he is, but I'll follow him because you said.
Right.
You know, it's much better rather than having a million of those, it's better to have like 10,000 people who actually sought you out on purpose and followed you because those people really.
Philosophically, I agree with you, but narcissistically,
do you want the number? Anytime you give someone a number, they want it to go up.
Well, yeah, and then you know, it's like it was such an ego thing, particularly in the performer community for so long. About how many followers? People would go, how many followers? And it's interesting now that the entertainment industry looks at those metrics, and that's actually a thing. They go, well, this person has this many followers, so we should probably work with them.
It's also woven into contracts now, like how many followers you have. It's like, we'll give you an extra 10 grand if you tweet this.
Yeah, exactly. That was a whole other thing of monetizing tweets for a while that people, I mean, I know some people still do it, but there were ads being served and a lot of rules with that. I mean, it's, you know, are there darker sides? You're like, I kind of wish it hadn't evolved in that direction, or are you pretty much fine with everything?
It's a reflection of the world. And people share their thoughts and what they think and their emotions. And the amazing thing is we have 10 years of sentiment, of emotion, all now archived to the Library of Congress.
It's true. We could go back. Yeah, the Library of Congress, we did a deal with them early to archive all the tweets, the public tweets, so that they were thinking, wouldn't it be great if we could have known what everyone was thinking in the 1800s and throughout the 1900s? And now for the last 10 years, we can go back, we can know what people were thinking 5 years ago.
I'm so glad that the Library of Congress has my old tweet of diarrhea is the jazz of poop. I'm really excited about that. I'm really excited that that's in the Library of Congress. This is from Brian Koppelman. Jack, I love Twitter as is. Why not promote grow lists so users curate their own timelines to their specs?
Lists are great. I use them a lot in Moments is actually an evolution of collections another evolution of lists so that people can see it in a more visual way and in a fast way. So we're always looking to make sure that the fundamentals that we started with, we get better and better, and we build more utility into it.
Excellent. This is from Dave Elliott at the underscore Iceman 2288. There's like 50 characters. But I'm curious, do you guys say the at symbol? I always say the at symbol before I say someone's username, or do you just say their username?
I say the at
too, because otherwise it might be their actual name. That's weird.
I mean, because
unless it's Ev or Jack, because it's...
Right, because they're your friends.
Well, also, like, I don't call him at Jack.
I say it though.
I mean, this show that I did for Comedy Central at midnight, we created the show a few years ago. It was originally a pilot called Tweeterdome, and it was all Twitter-centric games. And then we were like, well, we should expand it so any social community can be involved, because let's just make it about the way that people interact with the internet. And I said, well, the name of the show should also be the at name. That'll tell you that it's an internet-based show, and it's also the time. So even just something as simple as a username can inform so much about, you know, like, what, it's not just a person's name. It can really be,
right?
How do you see it in terms of like integration with brands? Are there wise things that you see people do, or companies where you're like, yeah, maybe that's not...
Well, there's a lot of newscasters and stuff that write on the thing, that the whatever that's called, that they put on the bottom.
Oh, the news crawl.
They're talking. Yeah. It says like their name, and then it says at whatever. And so you know right away, like, oh, you can follow them on Twitter too.
Yeah.
That was amazing to see, like, the first time we saw the at names and the hashtags on television.
Yeah, showing up on TV, we're like, whoa.
And also physically around the world, too, because you knew exactly where it was. You knew that it was on Twitter. You knew how to get to it. And it was amazing.
So, at now the Iceman 2288, when are we going to get an edit button?
This person wants an edit button. Mm.
Never heard that request before.
Right. That's so strange. You've never heard that before. So.
Yeah.
Forget more.
Well, I guess
just put that in the list of ideas.
Well, we could put a button in there.
Yeah. Just a button.
Just to make, if it makes it feel, people feel better, just put an edit button.
But then you can only edit whatever's in the button.
Yeah.
It's a literal
edit button. You can edit the button.
It's literally going
to turn.
It's an interesting thing, though. I think the way we used it initially was more ephemeral. It was more like of the moment, and you didn't really think about these things were going to stick around for a while and they needed to edit it. It was something that it was consciousness. You just kept sharing what you were thinking. So back then, it wasn't around editing. It was just like this of the moment thing.
Yeah. And it's tricky, by the way. People ask this all the time, and we shouldn't trivialize it. Obviously, one of the biggest things I've learned about the internet after helping people put their thoughts on it for 20 years is people regret putting their thoughts on the internet. And so a blogger many years ago, it was hard by default, your blog post showed up with your name. And then we got all these frantic emails, oh my God, how did I get my name off the internet attached to my thought?
Right.
And so we had to build that then. But the idea of an edit button seems trivial, but then people respond to your tweet,
that's the trick.
And you are
or retweet it, and you
retweet it, and then you change it. It actually has many complications to it that people don't necessarily think about. So, not that it's impossible or that it shouldn't be done, but I just want to point out every decision like that, just so people know, has very broad implications, not only technically but behaviorally, and changes the nature of everything.
Yeah, I could say I love Jack, and then everyone would be like, oh, that's great, and they can like, Biz said he loves Jack, and retweet, and then go edit and say I hate Jack, and everyone's like, why is everyone retweeting this? Like, this is a mean thing to say,
right?
You know, I mean, it's just it's
right.
True stuff.
So better delete it,
and then start over.
Well, I think that's what because when you're dealing with that many millions, hundreds of millions of people, and you obviously care about what you're doing, it's kind of funny that I guess sometimes people go, oh, they probably didn't think of this. It's
exactly.
Like, but all you do is think about this stuff all day.
For 10 years.
So how do you not get jaded when you're working so hard to create something that you obviously care about, and then people yell at you and say, like, you're dumb because you didn't do this. It's like, yeah, we did. You don't understand all the details.
No, but when they do that, they're passionate about it, and that means they like it. So I'd rather have people hate, like, you're stupid, you don't do this, and they're still passionate about the product, or have people be like, I love this, I love it. The in-between of just, I don't care what you do, is the worst.
Yeah. You don't want people to be apathetic.
I'd rather they'd be really pissed or they'd be really happy, but not in between. Like, yeah, whatever you do is fine. Yeah, maybe, who cares? It's better that way. It's like there's a lot more energy there.
So just sort of going down, I'll just ask you guys a couple more questions, and then we'll release you back into the wilds of Twitter.
Catch and release.
This is the catch and release program. I think I'm going to mount you, though. I'll just mount you up on the mantelpiece. And
if you edit that after the first thing, it's going to be weird.
This is where I would need a Twitter edit feature.
Yeah.
This is where I would need a Twitter edit feature.
The Periscope.
The Periscope.
You just pointed at him and said...
I'm going to mount you. Yeah. I meant as in taxidermy. I didn't mean any other
which
way.
Which isn't weird at all.
Which you might... Yeah. Both options are... like, why would you say that to him?
Just got dark.
Your body language just changed. You just got very protective.
Yeah, it's fine. He had more tweets.
No. Give me that.
All right.
What are you?
This is very real time and live.
Yeah,
this is really how we do it.
Twitter.
There's no servers. It goes right to our printer.
Yeah, it's like one of those. It's one of those old timey, where it's just the cards come out. It's just the blinking lights.
It's a telegram.
It's a telegram. It's like an Altair 8800 might be a fun computer that you could reference.
Which I just did.
What are you most passionate about now? What are you most passionate about on Twitter about? I mean, within Twitter, what are you passionate about?
The speed and simplicity of being able to see the world. I mean, we break news 10 to 15 minutes before any other service, and it's right from the streets. It's right from the source. Like, it's a very authentic and genuine voice, and it just makes you so much closer to where something is happening, and it's an amazing opportunity to learn about the world and the learning that Twitter provides on a daily basis through the tweets, but also through Periscope. It's just phenomenal.
The same thing for me. Jack and I had a meeting really early on, like 2008 or something, with Reuters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a funny story. We were totally drunk, but I pitched them. I was like, "What if we gave you just a feed of everything that's going on right now in the world?" And Jack was like, "We don't have that." And I was like, "Don't worry, you'll make it." and the guy was like, "Whoa! Like, let me bring in my other guys." And so, because now it has become that. It's become the world's terminal for breaking news, and it's like so exciting to see that happen. To go on Moments in the Morning and just scan it and be like, okay, cool, I know what's going on. Or anything, like he said, anything that's breaking, it's finally there. There's finally hundreds of millions of people on it all around the world saying what's going on right now, whatever they're seeing. It's not just these isolated moments of like, oh my God, a plane landed in the Hudson. That's happening every day somewhere.
We get to have a conversation about it as well.
Yeah, and then you can, follow up.
And what we can do with that, we've only scratched the surface of. If there's these hundreds of millions of tweets a day talking about what's happening, it's going beyond just the people you follow and how, you know, when you happen to dip your toe into that stream, using the intelligence of that network and intelligence of all these brains to actually serve people and make it useful, not just about sucking up their time and consuming more information, but what can we do for you today that makes your life better by telling you something you didn't know right now, or giving you the opportunity to connect to someone, be they next door around the world. There's still so much we can do that hundreds of people in this building are working on. I'm really excited to see what's next.
So as we're winding this down, is there any kind of common misconception about Twitter that you want to clear up? Like maybe something you see a lot of that you wanted to say to a lot of people at once, like, no, it's this instead of this. Is there anything you can think of?
That you have to tweet to get any value out of it. I mean, I think that the value starts in what Ev said. You get to see the world and you get to learn about it. And we can present you this really unique perspective that you won't find anywhere else. And it's not necessarily the friends that you bring to Twitter or the people that you know in real life. It's who you're introduced to. It's who you're introduced to because you're interested in a particular idea or a topic or a community, and the social relationship that you build off that is really, really compelling.
Yeah, that was always frustrating to me when we were counting the tweets and the number of people who signed up to tweet. And I said, like, look, you don't need to know how to code to use the internet. And if we counted all the tweets that got read, whether it's on Twitter or third-party applications or TV or newspapers or the radio, like, there's billions and billions of tweets being looked at every day. So, like, you know, we have a viewership of something like 22 billion views a day or something like that. I mean, that's pretty good for...
That's not bad.
That's not bad.
And where do you see it all? Where do you see it all going? Do you see it? I mean, obviously, Twitter has evolved from basically an SMS tool to its own thing. So where do you see that, like, integrating it into, I don't know, wearable technology or AR, or like how do you see Twitter evolving and weaving into the way that people live their lives in the future?
The amazing thing is it fits everywhere. I mean, it goes into every medium that's created. So whether it's VR down the line or video, like the idea of being able to instantly broadcast your thoughts and seeing the world in real time and having a conversation is everywhere.
Historically, like throughout history, when you get the information first, you win. That's like financial markets, that's other things. Like, you get it first, you're ahead, you can make the decision before anyone else. So it's got value no matter where you put it.
And that speed is important.
Like, yeah.
We can break and tell you first.
There can be an earthquake in San Jose, and someone can tweet about it, and you can be up here in San Francisco and say, get ready, everybody.
So, two more questions. One of them being, again, to people who are starting up their own thing, you guys achieved this incredible success. I know, I see you. I see you over there. Hang on.
What, she's starting up her helicopter?
She's starting up a helicopter. She's just gone through the roof. She's just gone through the roof. Because these last two questions I think are really, really important. And the one being for startups now, for people who are embarking on their Twitter, once you became very successful, how did that, you know, how were you able to sort of maintain that mentally? Like, when the thing did happen that you wanted to happen and it exceeded all of your expectations, how did you stay grounded?
Well, first of all, I would say, you know, it probably isn't going to work out. I mean, like, everyone's like, oh, Twitter, you did it in your mom's basement. First thing you did, total success. Like, not really. I like to say it takes 10 years, a lot of hard work, and a lot of luck to become an overnight success. So there's that. And then if you are lucky enough to have right time, right people, right place, right idea, then you just have to... Like I said, be emotionally invested and make it better every day. Just every day, make it better. Be emotionally invested, and that's the only way you're going to be able to get through it.
In the 10 years, I've been on since like 2008, I think. One of the most special things to me was I'm getting my mom on Twitter. My mom loves Twitter. She swears about sports. She's got a ton of followers. And also when my dad passed away, I just quickly tweeted, like, you know, please just, I need to take some time off my dad. And the overwhelming amount of support from people just from that made me feel, it was such a comforting experience. What are each one of you, like, your favorite experiences? Do you have one particular favorite experience in the last 10 years?
I mean, like I said, mine was when Sarah said on Twitter, but... it just also when we had our boy, you know, I think I must have tweeted something out. I mean, the first thing he did after coming out was his little hand grabbed my finger, and I think I tweeted that out. I'm not sure, but he had a grip too.
strong.
But I mean, like, we've all, you know, Evan and I have become fathers since starting Twitter. Just so much has happened, you know, in the last 10 years. It's been amazing. Mm-hmm.
Well, congratulations. I hope we're sitting here again in 10 more years, or at least on some sort of a neural.
Or at least, you know, with taxidermy, yeah.
Yeah, today I will be taking you home. I'm not sure if I can get around the carry-on rule, but anyway, you're leaving with me, and there's nothing you can do about it. But I want to thank Jack and Biz and Ev. I mean, like I said, everything that I do and everything that most people do would not have existed without Twitter, and I'm so appreciative, and I know you guys work hard, and I know you care about it, so I care, and I know other people care. Thank you so much, and happy Twitter Day. Use the hashtag LoveTwitter. You'll get
happy
a little
birthday.
Heart and a little... Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now we could sing the happy birthday song, because it's now public domain. It's public domain now.
Is it really?
Public domain. Yeah, they wrestled it away from those ladies who were trying to corner the birthday market. Right, thanks, everyone, for watching. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.